Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome you to this, the second in the series of Social Market Foundation LSE public lectures, which are designed to examine the role of law, morality, and social consent in underpinning the workings of a market economy. In the first lecture, Howard Davis from the CBI examined how best to create a highly trained, highly skilled workforce in Britain capable of competing against our industrial competitors, something which we at the LSE also think we know something about. In June, Lord Lawson will revisit his May's lecture after 10 years to talk about the part government plays in shaping micro and macroeconomic policy and how it has changed in the intervening decade. One we're all looking forward to. But today, we're delighted, and I'm particularly, personally delighted, to welcome David Sainsbury, who will address us on company performance in a social market. I cannot think of anyone better qualified to talk about this subject. He started work with the family firm in 1963 after Cambridge and Columbia, New York education. He became finance director of J. Sainsbury in 1973 and is now chairman and chief executive. David is also, of course, a patron of the Social Market Foundation. The foundation was set up in 1989 specifically to stimulate public discussion on the performance of markets and the social framework within which they operate. It is now one of Britain's leading independent think tanks, contributing ideas to all sides of the political debate. And I have no doubt that what David has to say will live up to that tradition, as well, of course, as the great tradition of J. Sainsbury. And it therefore gives me very great pleasure to invite him to talk to us this evening. He has said that after the lecture, we'll take questions. David.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the first paper produced by the Social Market Foundation, Lord Skelelsky outlined the social market philosophy adopted in Germany after the last war. The architects of the social market economy saw it as having four main features. These were competition, a sound currency, equality of opportunity, and co-determination. The state, therefore, had three main roles: to create and maintain the necessary legal framework for market exchange, to limit and supplement the market as appropriate, and to make certain that the social arrangements within which the market operates are considered fair. Industry, I believe, is inevitably to operate within a framework of regulations, institutions, infrastructure, and policies shaped by government. And the task of policymakers is to design these in such a way as to harness the dynamism and innovation of the market to achieving the long-term economic and social goals of society. I want to look this evening at one part of this task, at how government can shape the regulations, institutions, infrastructure, and policies that affect the performance of companies in such a way as to maximize their wealth-creating capacity. In looking at how government can help the wealth-creating capacity of industry, I start from two strong beliefs. Firstly, it is companies that create wealth. It is they that have to build and sustain a competitive advantage over their rivals in foreign countries. And any attempt at shadow decision-making by government should be avoided at all costs. Given the complexity and speed of most product markets today, there is no way that even the most able civil servants can make decisions about the strategies that companies should pursue. Government should not get directly involved in corporate decision-making, but should seek to create an environment in which all companies can build competitive advantage. As Michael Porter wrote in The Competitive Advantage of Nations, government is indeed an actor in international competition, but rarely does it have a starring role. Secondly, building and maintaining competitive advantage in world markets today is a tough and demanding task. It requires constant improvement and sustained commitment. It means endless challenge. most companies would prefer to have a protected or controlled market. If government seeks to put a brake on economic change by protecting companies or giving them assistance, they will not make the necessary changes. Subsidies have almost never been associated with the building of competitive advantage. Usually they simply delay adjustment and innovation. Protection, for the same reasons, is equally undesirable. It's usually justified on the grounds that it gives industry a breathing space in which to adjust itself. But it's difficult to think of any mature industry anywhere which has made itself into a world-class competitor after a period of protection. To achieve productivity growth, a nation's economy must constantly change and upgrade itself, and the role of government must be to help it do so, not to provide it with easier options. In thinking about how government can help companies create wealth, it's necessary to define precisely our economic goals. It's almost universally agreed that we need to be a competitive nation, but competitiveness can have two very different meanings. In the first sense, it's used to mean simply the relative prices at which a nation's goods exchange in world markets. Those prices may be low only because the rewards to capital and labour employed to make them are low as a result of, for example, devaluation, poor profits, or a declining standard of living relative to competing nations. Competitiveness, in that sense, cannot be seen as a desirable goal for a nation. In the second sense, competitiveness is used to mean the ability of companies to expand and to produce high and rising levels of productivity, and therefore a high and rising standard of living for a nation's citizens. Productivity in this context is defined as the value of goods produced by a unit of labour or capital. It's a function of both the quality and features of the goods sold, and therefore their desirability to customers, and the efficiency with which they are made. Productivity defined in this way is what in the long term produces the standard of living of a country, as it determines national per capita income, and should be seen as the goal of national economic policy. To produce increasing levels of productivity over time, a nation's companies must continuously upgrade themselves. In existing industries, they must raise product quality, introduce new products, and increase production efficiency. They must also develop the capability to compete in new and more sophisticated industries. This will involve the movement of less productive jobs to developing countries, either through foreign investment or foreign sourcing. If less productive jobs are being transferred overseas, this is an entirely healthy process. But if high productivity jobs are being lost, this will clearly damage long-term prosperity. The main goal of government policy should therefore be to create an environment in which all companies can upgrade their competitive advantages and in this way produce a rising standard of living for the country. A high level of productivity allows a high level of income and the resources to pay for public services. It also enables a nation's companies to meet high standards in such areas as the environment and health and safety without compromising their international competitiveness. A strategy based on upgrading productivity is not only more socially desirable than one based on low wages and a favourable exchange rate, it also makes more economic sense. We live in a world awash with cheap labour. Because of the growth of literacy which is taking place in the third world, cheap labour, which once could not be used because it was not productive enough, is now starting to reach productivity levels which make it competitive in world markets. According to the 1991 World Development Report, between 1965 and 1988, secondary school enrollment increased from 26% to 55% of the school-age population in the 58 middle-income developing countries, and tertiary enrollment jumped from 7% to 17%. There are now no more than 600 million literate workers in the world able to do complex manufacturing jobs, but it's been calculated that in the next 20 years, the figure could rise to 3 billion. If our only weapon in competing for jobs is low labour costs, we will always be outbid by a country whose workers are prepared to accept lower wages. If the goal of industry is to produce an increasing level of productivity, then the answers to a number of other key industrial issues become clear. For example, it is pointless to spend a lot of time trying to classify industries into categories such as high-tech and low-tech, sunrise and sunset, growing and mature. The new technologies such as electronics, advanced materials, and biotechnology will have applications in many industries, and industrialized countries should not regard a few high-technology sectors as the only refuge from low-wage developing countries. This is the place where they have the greatest advantage, but these sectors will be able to provide only a small part of total added value and employment. Companies should seek to compete in all those segments of industry where high technological and management skills can create competitive advantage. And government should seek to provide an environment in which all industries can compete if firms are innovative and achieve high productivity. Equally, manufacturing should not be seen as an inherently more virtuous activity than services. The key issue, again, is whether high productivity or low productivity jobs are being created. When people think of service jobs, they tend to think of low-paid young people flipping hamburgers in a fast food restaurant. But brain surgeons, bankers, and lawyers are also service workers. The UK, for example, exports more than 500 million a year of legal services, and we've had a trade surplus in legal services for every year since at least 1970. If everyone in this country was employed in a high added value service job, we would be doing extremely well. But we should remember that manufactured goods account for around 80% of world trade, while services account for only 20%. And between 1980 and 1990, international trade in services grew no faster than trade in manufactured goods, so that in the timescale relevant to public services, we'll have to rely on having a substantial and successful manufacturing sector. If our principal goal as a nation is to produce a high and rising standard of living by a high and rising standard of productivity, we need to understand the process whereby companies increase productivity so that government policies are developed which support rather than hinder it. If all that is necessary to create competitive advantage is the energy of a few entrepreneurs, then public policy should encourage shareholders to give them large incentives and golden handshakes. If, however, the creation of competitive advantage increasingly depends on the skills and initiative of the whole workforce, then government needs to make certain that the country's education and training system is producing people with the necessary skills and should encourage companies to extend profit sharing to all their employees. The first point that needs to be made about the process of creating competitive advantage is that it's a dynamic process. The companies that are most successful are those that improve and innovate continuously. Companies, therefore, often perform best when they are under pressure. Italian firms moved into more sophisticated industry segments, for example, not when the lira was cheap, but when a rising lira in the 1970s forced them to upgrade products and bring in new technology. I recently visited the Benetton headquarters at Treviso, and they told me that they felt their decision to go on producing garments in northern Italy, rather than making products in the Far East with cheap labor, had been an important factor in stimulating them to produce knitting machinery which could make a whole sweater without any stitching. Similarly, as the yen rose in the late 1980s against other major countries, Japanese companies reduced the break-even point for the profitability of their exports from 210 yen to the dollar in September 1985 to 114 yen in March 1988. As the yen rose to 150 to the dollar, workers at Canon's Torii factory wore 150 badges to demonstrate their commitment to the cost-cutting program necessary to achieve profitability at that level. Attempts, therefore, by government to reduce factor costs to help industry tend not to be successful in the long term. This is because factor costs tend only to be decisive in those industries where technology is unsophisticated and basic factor costs are a high proportion of the cost structure. In most high productivity industry segments, innovation is the key to competitive advantage. A major problem with devaluation, for example, is the impact it has on the process of upgrading an economy. Instead of having to improve quality, reduce their cost structure, and introduce new models, companies are able to survive and encouraged to move into price-sensitive segments of industry. Of course, a balance has to be struck here. Currency pressures should not, for example, be so great that they make it impossible for companies to compete whatever they do. The second obvious feature of the process of creating competitive advantage is the key role played by technological and management skills. The basic way that a company creates economic value and builds up competitive advantage is by producing a product that meets a market need better than its competitors. But how well a product performs depends on the technology that goes into it. The creation of economic value is therefore a coupling process which brings together technology and customer needs and requires managers who have enough knowledge of an industry and its technologies to engage in a real discussion of technological developments, competitors' strategies, and product opportunities. The importance of technological skills to creating competitive advantage has been well illustrated in a series of brilliant studies done by the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, comparing major product manufacturing plants in Germany and Britain. I'm glad to say they were done, directed by Professor Sieg Price, who I'm glad to see is in the audience here this evening. These have shown clearly that a lack of intermediate skills has had a devastating effect on the competitiveness of British industry. I'd like to look in detail at one of these studies, the one done on the manufacture of women's outerwear, because it illustrates very clearly many of the points I've been making. Wages and other social on-costs are between 50 and 100% higher in Germany than in Britain. But in Germany, industry has been successful in manufacturing women's outerwear. It has done so by producing small batches of high-quality goods in great variety, while British industry has depended largely on manufacturing long runs of standard items. For example, the typical length of production run in women's outerwear in Germany is 150 to 300 garments, compared with approximately 15,000 garments in the UK. German garments are of a higher quality and more styled, and involve shorter production runs, but are made by fewer employees. The difference in productivity between Germany and the UK in the women's outerwear industry does not lie in investment or new technology, but in the skills of the workforce. The researchers from the National Institute found that some 80% of all machinists in the German plants that they visited had completed a full two-year apprenticeship, while they could not find a single machinist in the UK with a similar qualification. As part of their training, the German machinists had mastered all the operations used in garment making. Consequently, when they had to start work on a new style, they needed on average only 2 days to reach 100% speeds. Their training also meant that they were able to work directly from technical sketches when starting a new operation. In the British plants, however, there were only a few machinists who had learnt more than a few basic operations, and therefore, when they had to tackle a new style, they usually took several weeks to reach 100% speeds. The German supervisors were also better trained. They had all completed a three-year apprenticeship and an additional work-study course, while 9 out of 10 of the British supervisors had no formal vocational qualification. I think this study is of great interest because it demonstrates the vital role that training plays in creating competitive advantage, the importance of national training systems, and how the corporate strategy of a company can to some extent be determined by the quality of its workforce. A third requirement for success in creating competitive advantage is long-term commitment. Competitive advantage is not something that can be built up over a couple of years. It depends on a long process of investing in human skills, upgrading products and processes, and building up strong positions in foreign markets. The export drive of Japanese car manufacturers started in the 1950s, but it was not until the 1970s that they began to achieve strong market shares abroad. Economists tend always to think in terms of the mobility of resources, and the mobility of resources is essential to the upgrading of economy if resources are not to remain locked into situations where a company cannot become competitive. But often when a new product is being produced, or a new business developed, or an export position built up in a new country, losses will arise. In these circumstances, a manager has to take a decision, either to continue because he believes that he can improve the productivity of resource utilization, or to reallocate the resources. It's essential that such decisions are taken on the basis of a long-term view of a company's prospects, and it's therefore vitally important that the goals of managers are long-term ones. This point has obvious implications for the way that managers are remunerated. Finally, it's important to realize that a revolution in work organization is taking place in factories and offices, and that this has important implications for the achievement of competitive advantage. Around the world, the best companies are moving away from mass production and Taylorism and organizing work around highly skilled, well-paid workers using high-performance work organizations. These companies are using the intelligence and skills of their workers more fully than in the past, and as a result are unleashing major advances in productivity, quality, variety, and speed of new product introductions. Workers are asked to use judgment and to assume responsibility for tasks such as production scheduling and quality control that others used to do. Worldwide, the ratio between indirect workers and direct workers in automobile assembly plants is 3-1. In the best plants, however, it's 2-1. The difference lies in the amount of responsibility assumed by the direct workers who actually assemble the cars. But to work effectively, these new high-performance work organizations required large numbers of well-educated and well-motivated workers. In these circumstances, it's essential that companies align the interests of the individuals who make up an organization with the long-term interests of the organization itself. These, then, are some of the basic requirements for success in world markets today. In most cases, management needs to take the initiative to put in place the necessary policies for success. But equally, governments can shape the regulations, institutions, infrastructure, and policies that affect the performance of companies in such a way as to help them increase productivity and upgrade. There are four main areas where I believe government can shape the environment to help companies to compete in world markets. Firstly, governments can help to upgrade the factors of production that companies use, such as labor, capital, knowledge, and infrastructure. Increasingly, the factors of production, which are most essential to productivity growth, are created within a nation rather than inherited. Whereas in the past, natural resources, climate, location, and unskilled and semi-skilled labor are important, today such factors of production as graduate engineers and computer scientists, specialized research institute, and modern digital data communications are the key to success. An industry which has been surprisingly successful is the Dutch flour industry. In 1990, it accounted for 59% of the world's export of cut flours and 48% of the world's bedding plant exports. These large market shares are heavily dependent on specialized factors of production. The existence of highly specialized research organizations in flour cultivation, packaging, and shipping, such as the Spener Institute and the Alsmaar Research Station, are vitally important to its success. It also has an extremely efficient infrastructure in flour handling and air freight. The most important factor of production in an increasing number of industries is, however, a highly educated and skilled labor force. And education and training are probably the single most important way that governments can help to upgrade industry. In this country, we will not find it easy to produce the number of world-class companies we need unless we make further changes to our educational system. These involve raising the level of attainment of many of our students in basic subjects such as mathematics, creating a high prestige and effective technical stream in our schools, which will capture the enthusiasm of pupils who excel in practical subjects, and replacing A-levels with a system which requires all students to take a wider range of courses up to the age of 18. We're almost certainly about to enter a period when the tradable sectors of the economy will create few new jobs for unskilled people, and where there'll be a closer correlation between income and education than ever before. In the last 15 years in America, unskilled young people have suffered a disastrous drop in their real earnings, and this is probably a sign of what is to come. There's a real danger that in the future, we will face a situation where many people cannot contribute greater added value per capita than the level of welfare which our society feels obliged to provide, and you are therefore condemned to a life of poverty and unemployment. The most direct and productive way to tackle this problem is by reforming our educational system in the ways I've mentioned. These reforms would go a long way to improving the capacity of those in the bottom 40% of the ability range to make a contribution to society, and would therefore prevent them from having to rely on the welfare system for a minimum standard of living. They would not only help industry to upgrade, but also lead to a more socially just society. A second way that government can encourage the upgrading of industry is by affecting the demand conditions of industry. This it can do both through its role as a buyer of goods and services and through regulations that affect product standards and the processes through which they are made. In both cases, government policies can either encourage or hinder competitive advantage. For example, there can be no doubt that when British Telecom Communications was a state monopoly, it had a disastrous effect on the telecommunications supply industry in this country because it excluded foreign suppliers and laid down idiosyncratic standards for the industry, which made it very difficult for the supply industry to sell its products to the rest of the world. On the other hand, in Denmark, and the National Health Service provides free clinical testing in Danish hospitals for new products, and this is the part of the explanation why Denmark does so well in the healthcare sector. Strict standards for product performance can also help to create and upgrade competitive advantage. Japan established tough quality standards for export goods in the 1950s and 60s, and these certainly were a stimulus to improving quality in Japanese industry. Strict regulations are particularly helpful if they anticipate standards that other countries eventually adopt. Sweden's tough standards for product safety and environmental protection have led to a number of companies achieving competitive advantage in a number of different industries. Atlas Copco, for example, has been successful with quiet compressors that can be used in urban areas without disturbing nearby residents. A third area where government has an important role to play is in competition and trade policy. Government must do all it can to ensure a vigorous level of domestic competition. Cartels and restrictive practices are very dangerous in any industry which is seeking to achieve competitive advantage in world markets. For example, Switzerland's national competitive advantage in industries such as watches and beers was undermined in the past by cartels. A strong antitrust policy is essential to the upgrading of an economy, and in this country, this should include a tougher approach to the vast numbers of mergers and acquisitions. The amount of merger and acquisition activity has done little to upgrade industry. It also shortens the time horizons of management, because managers are reluctant to undertake long-term investment, which may temporarily depress profits and make them vulnerable to a takeover. A policy of encouraging rivalry between domestic companies needs to be matched by a commitment to free trade. Companies will not become world-class ones if they are protected from world-class competition by restricted public purchasing or voluntary export restraint agreements. Inward investment is also an area where government should have a clear and consistent policy which is aimed at upgrading industry. The issues surrounding inward investment were brilliantly discussed by Robert Reich, now Secretary of Labour in President Clinton's cabinet, a couple of years ago in two articles in the Harvard Business Review entitled "Who Is Us and Who Is Them?" He pointed out that American-owned multinationals are now beginning to employ large numbers of foreigners relative to their American workforces, are beginning to rely more on foreign facilities to do their technologically complex activities, and are beginning to export more from their foreign facilities. He then described two corporations, Corporation A and Corporation B, and asked which company the American government should support. Top management of Corporation A are citizens of the US, and the majority of shares are held by American investors. But most of Corporation A employees are non-Americans, and it undertakes much of its R&D, product design, and complex manufacturing in Asia, Latin America, and Europe. Corporation B, on the other hand, is headquartered abroad, and most of its top managers and shareholders are foreigners. But most of Corporation B's employees are Americans, and it undertakes much of its R&D, new product design, and complex manufacturing in the US. In examining this question, Reich argued that as every advanced economy becomes global, a nation's most important competitive asset becomes the skills and cumulative learning of its workforce. Consequently, it does not matter whether a company is headquartered in the United States or abroad. The good American company is the one that equips Americans' workforce best to compete in the global economy. In other words, the company should be encouraged to invest, which most helps to upgrade industry. Increasingly, the global manager is locating activities in that part of the world which will maximize the performance of the company. Mazda's sports car, the MX-5 Miata, was designed in California, financed from Tokyo and New York. Its prototype was created in this country in Worthing, and it was assembled in Michigan and Mexico using advanced electronic components invented in New Jersey and made in Japan. As a country, we should seek to have the most productive and best paid jobs located in the UK by providing foreign investors with a highly skilled and productive workforce. Fourthly, government can help or hinder the upgrading of industry through legislation that influences the way companies are run. This includes laws relating to corporate governance, trade unions, and tax incentives. For example, if a government wants to encourage industry to take a long-term view of investment, it can give favorable tax treatment to long-term capital gains on equity investments in companies. In this country, we've equalized tax rates on income and capital gains. This is a policy which I believe attaches too much importance to financial market efficiency and too little to encouraging companies to take a long-term view. Government can also influence the motivation of individuals through policies that provide access to careers based on merit. Such policies encourage people to believe that everyone can be successful if they work hard and acquire skills. They include policies such as access to the educational system for all and tough policies against discrimination. These are the main areas where government can help industry to increase its productivity and upgrade. A number of rules, however, should be laid down to make certain that government does contribute to the dynamism of industry and does not distort its policy to help special interest groups. Firstly, government should play a direct role only in those areas where firms can't act, such as competition policy, or where externalities mean the firms underinvest. Examples are general education, environmental quality, transport, and those types of R&D that boost productivity in many industries. Government should start from a view that market-based solutions on balance work better than most others, and that the prime aim of public policy should be to make them work better. Government should always remember that policy failure is at least as much a problem as market failure. Secondly, government policies should always be assessed in terms of the contribution they make to the dynamism and sustained productivity growth. They should only be pursued if they contribute to these goals. Governments in nearly all nations today are seeking to improve their national competitiveness, whether it's by devaluation, privatization, research cooperation between firms, or reforms of their education systems. All these policies should be tested against whether they lead to an upgrading of the economy. Thirdly, all government policies which affect industry should, as far as possible, be subject to a market test. If we take, for example, R&D policy, then direct grants or subsidies to firms are of doubtful value. If firms do not have to bear any of the financial risk of a project, they will not put their best people on it or manage it well. A better route is the part funding of specialized research institutes and research contracts between companies and research institutes. Equally, if government wants to stimulate product development, it is better if it provides incentives to companies to be early purchasers of sophisticated products than if it subsidizes companies to produce them. A focus on buyers preserves the disciplines of firms having to match the needs of their customers, and rivalry among competitive firms can also be stimulated. If these three rules are followed, then government can have a positive contribution to the creation of a high productivity, high wage economy. The ideas I put forward in this lecture may sound very different from those put forward by the architects of the social market in Germany, but they're very similar. There is the same belief in competition and a sound currency, and the same emphasis on equality of opportunity and the involvement of the whole workforce. These are not seen as social constraints on industry, but as essential parts of a dynamic and innovative economy. The social market is not only an attractive political philosophy, but also the best way to create an environment in which industry can produce increasing levels of productivity over time, and therefore provide a nation's citizens with a rising standard of living. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, David. As I said when introducing David Sainsbury, he, I thought rather bravely, really, considering some of the reputation of what goes on in this theatre, but he did say he would be prepared to answer questions. I think it would be helpful if those of you who wanted to ask a question could just put your hand up and say who you were and where you were from. And David, it might help if you were to stand here and I were to sort of conduct things from there. Max.
No, I would have thought American agriculture was a rather good example of many of the things that I was talking about. I mean, I think people forget there was, I think, a period in the 19th century when actually Russian grain was exported more than American grain. What changed that round was the very extensive program of development which took place, which was very largely, I think, on the whole question of training people, enabling them through providing them with capital to buy equipment, and just raising the whole skill level and the way things are done. And I think the extension program of the American Department of Agriculture is one of the great success stories. But that, I would have thought, was a supreme example of what I've been talking about in terms of increasing the factors of production, of specialized factors of production, which help industry grow. I would have thought the amount of protection of American agriculture is rather limited. It's other people that are trying to keep American agriculture out, by and large. If you take the reverse situation, which is the rice industry in Japan, which is highly protected, it's by and large become extremely inefficient, I think. And actually, I think you can find examples where industry has been protected in the early stages of development. And that rather goes against what I said, because my remarks were entirely about mature industries as a whole. What I think you can find is examples where You have protection of, say, the motorcycle industry in Japan in its early days. But what you had was 50 companies competing against each other. You didn't need to have any competition from outside. What took place was a process of slaughter among these companies. When you were down then to the dozen or so companies which were really effective, quite rightly, then the barriers were brought down and they started competing on world markets. But throughout that process, they didn't lack for competitive pressures. Well, I mean, look at how that was done. I mean, it was done, I think, partly again by stimulating the development of companies to develop robots. But what was interesting about that was that they didn't support companies. What they did is give people the resources to buy the robots from companies. And, of course, that's what stimulated the production of the robot makers to develop it. So, again, you had the competitive pressures of people wanting to buy robots. You didn't get away from the market test of it. I think that's what I was trying to say. It's always better to help people buy the equipment rather than actually just saying, well, here's a subsidy to do it.
Yes.
My name is Alec Rose, and I may be in a unique position here tonight because I'm a graduate of the school, a pensioner of Martin Spencer, and a customer of Sainsbury's.
Right. Right.
The one point that I would take you up on in your lecture is this point you made about women's outerwear. I don't know whether you discussed this with Sir Richard Greenbury, but I don't think he would agree with you that the way to become more competitive is to restrict the dozens of the long lines of production.
Right.
Actually, I think the company has succeeded in being very competitive worldwide. In fact, since I retired, it's become an international business. It's done much better since I left, anyhow.
Right.
I think that this good hardware question, there's another angle to that, and I wondered whether you'd had an opportunity to discuss this question.
Well, I have a sort of... have to be very careful here, because I'm also I have a small company which is a supplier of it, Marks and Spencer's, in the clothing industry. So it's actually an industry I know quite well. And I think there is a real issue here. But I don't think it's not driven by the retail end. It's driven by the question of the caliber of the people who actually work in the factories. And the sad story is that if you look at the textile industry in this country, while we probably have in Marks and Spencer the greatest sort of clothing retailer in the world probably, who can actually, in most parts of the world, have a unique product, the fact is that our clothing industry is on a constant decline. And a lot of the goods are now coming in from places like Morocco and elsewhere. And even Marks and Spencer's, with all its bias towards British manufacturing, is actually taking in goods from those countries. And the reason is simply about the cheap labor there gives you more of an advantage than increased skills can do in this country. So that when you're talking about basic garments, then it's better to get them from the cheap labor countries. And that's a very difficult trend to alter unless the clothing industry begins to move in the higher value-added segments.
In the balcony.
Thank you.
enormous food for thought. As I was listening to it, I couldn't help remember, obviously, that the LSE is actually a company too. It's a somewhat historical accident that we were given a corporate structure by Sidney and Beatrice Webb. No obvious great supporters of capitalism, I seem to remember. But the LSE is actually corporately a company limited by guarantee. And I kept, as you went through your list of things, just wondering, you know, instead of motorcycles and all these widget things, I kept asking what lessons there would be for LSE Limited, which is what we are. And I think it's often forgotten that education, as well as being a factor for production, is, of course, a business in its own right. And I just had two rather competing thoughts. On the one hand, undoubtedly, the British government's policy of opening British education to foreign students has had an enormously beneficial influence, not only on the LSE, where it's obvious, but on the whole range of British higher education, and indeed in the school sector too. On the other hand, the existence of a highly centralised bureaucratic monster like the Higher Education Funding Council for England, which directly gives subsidies, probably, at least as far as the LSE is concerned this week, has probably been unhelpful. And where the balance of advantage lies in that, perhaps we can take up at the reception. But David, thank you very much indeed.